Good evening. My name is Max Wayland, and I'm a student project manager at the Clark Forum for Contemporary Issues at Dickinson College. On behalf of the Clark Forum, I'd like to welcome you to tonight's event, Leading Greatly, Why Liberal Arts Education Matters. We attach great value to leadership. Politicians and business people are constantly scrutinized in terms of their leadership skills and attitudes. Leadership style is hotly debated, whether it's pundits on cable TV or commentators on ESPN questioning the judgments of athletes and umpires. With all this importance placed on leadership, it makes sense that we reflect on how education prepares us for our roles in leadership in the future. For this purpose, we welcome Dr. Michael Schenkman, class of 68, back to campus to discuss the topic. Dr. Schenkman is founder and president of the Arch of Leadership, a leadership mentoring company. Schenkman is a pioneer in his field. His leader mentoring program is among the first fully developed mentoring curricula being offered to colleges, businesses, and service organizations. He's taught at the University of New Mexico and at the Boston Architectural College. Dr. Schenkman has also published 4 books. The Arch on the Path, The Life of Leading Greatly, has been called, quote, challenging, perceptive, innovative, and aware, unquote. His most recent publication, Leader Mentoring, Find, Inspire, and Cultivate Great Leaders, has also been very well received by critics. They call it a boldly unique work that blends wit and wisdom to remind us of the forgotten art of mentoring in a book that no high-level decision-maker should miss. Dr. Schenkman is one of this year's Metzger Conway Fellows, a program established at Dickinson in 1982 that showcases graduates of distinction by their participation in various classes, meetings with faculty and student groups, and presenting lectures about their postgraduate work. This lecture is part of the Clark Forum's ongoing series of events on leadership in an age of uncertainty. At this time, please turn off all cell phones and other electronic devices. There will be a question-answer session after the lecture, so please hold your questions until then. Now, please join me in welcoming Dr. Michael Schenkman.
Hello. I want to thank all of you for taking time out of your busy days and your busy schedules to join us here tonight and to do some thinking about leading, mentoring, and most of all about aspiration, which is the main subject that I want to talk about tonight. I want to thank the people at the Clark Center for preparing a schedule for me, enabling me to meet with students and faculty over the past few days. And so I have two JRs to thank. Jim Rainey, first of all, for spending the time with me in New Mexico so that we could spend some time and talk and liked some of the things that we talked about, and I really appreciate him making it possible for me to be here. So thank you very much, Jim. And then Jolie Rankin, who put together my schedule, ferreted through all my emails and my various, very verbose requests and issues and that kind of thing, and she still put everything together and made this visit work. And I want to thank her, and I really appreciate all that she did to make that possible. Then there's the staff of students and others at the Clark Center who facilitated this visit. And I want to thank you all very much. And finally, I want to say that it's been more than 40 years, I guess 44 years or so since I've been back here. And being back here, I'm sorry that it's been so long. I'm really thrilled with everything that I see. I'm thrilled with the campus, the way it looks, the beautiful restoration work that's been done on the building. I've been thrilled and excited to meet and talk to the students and faculty that I have. I just have a real sense that this is an institution that really matters, that has a sense of core of values, and sticks to them and honors them. It brought up deep and fond memories, mostly fond memories of my days here from many, many years ago. And in that regard, I want to dedicate tonight's talk to Dan Bechtel and George Allen, who really made everything that I'm going to speak of tonight possible. I can't thank them enough. So thank you for coming, and this is for you. You know, I just find it amazing. It is amazing to be back here at Dickinson after all these many years. But it's also really amazing to be in a position of being honored. That's something I'm so totally unused to. In my business, and I've been at this kind of consulting business as an executive coach and then as a leader mentor for 30 years. And mostly what I get to hear in terms of working with clients is no thank you. no, we really can't afford that. Or no, thank you. This really doesn't fit with our strategic plan at the moment. You know, so mostly I hear no. And lately I've gotten to the point where when I'm cultivating a client, I urge them to say no to me. So I say when this leader mentoring really does its work, your organization has to be prepared to absorb the energy and excitement and vision that we have urged these people to offer. And your business has to be ready to accept that. And if you're not, then, you know, I say no to you. So then, of course, my parents were not particularly comprehending of what I was doing either. When I told them that I was going to be first a religion major and then a philosophy major, I just remember the day clearly. My father just went ballistic. He said, "I'm not spending all this money so that you could, you know, learn this useless stuff and, you know, da da da." I mean, he was just, you know, ballistic. So I'm used to getting that. And then finally, I can honestly say that, you know, practically on her deathbed, practically on her dying day, my mother still was asking me, "So what is it exactly that you do?" So the fact that Dickinson College, where really my life in this work began, has chosen to bring me here and give me the chance to meet with all of you, to restore my friendship and admiration with my mentors here, is just an amazing and powerfully moving event, and I want to thank everyone involved in doing that. I want to talk to you a little bit about what it is that I do. What is this thing called leader mentoring? I can assure you that I didn't invent it. This literally came on to me because a CEO that I had worked with for many, many years literally just didn't want me to leave after my executive coaching engagement was done. And he came up with a suggestion. He said, "Well, why don't you work with my stars? You know, the people I'm counting on to grow this organization, the people that I'm looking to for my successor, why don't you work with those people rather than the people that coaches work with? And that's the ones that we need to fix." So literally, I can remember that day just as plain. I can see the table that we were sitting at. I can see, you know, what was around the office. Because I knew that this was probably going to be the start of something. I didn't know what it would amount to. I'll talk to you about how I learned what it would become in a moment. But I knew that something different was going to happen. I was put into the situation. Being an executive coach, I had the habit of being alone in conference rooms, talking to executives and trying to, you know, kind of fix what wasn't working for them. But now I was going to be alone in conference rooms with people that really got it right, with people that were really excellent, with people that were, you know, people in their early and mid-30s that were rising up very rapidly in the organization, were being given increased responsibility. And my job was to do what exactly? So literally, it was a matter of finding out, well, what was it that these people needed? A couple things really became very clear to me in the early days of exploring that question. One was that these people really didn't have a sense They had managerial roles, line positions. They had authority in the hierarchy. They had responsibilities, bottom line tasks that they had to accomplish. But they really didn't know what about them, the people that reported to them, valued. They really didn't know what it was about them that made something about them special, so that they were able to, big things that others weren't able to do, they were able to do. And they didn't know why. Another profound moment of revelation about the issues that I was dealing with came to me when someone in the course of our meeting said to me, "Well, you know, sometimes I just feel like I'm faking it." And I heard that, then I started to hear that again and again. And I knew what that feeling was. I understood that feeling. You're putting it out there, you're just kind of wondering, well, you know, what is this about? And you put it out there anyway, but you don't really know what's happening all around you. So I started to get the feeling that, you know, I was in the job of forming some kind of a connection for these people with who they were and what they were able to accomplish in their lives. So eventually I came to the conclusion that what I was doing was not coaching, happily, but I was doing something else. And I really started to think that maybe this is mentoring. Maybe this is what a mentor does. Maybe what a mentor does is help somebody find that connection within them that enables them to step out in their own lives in a way that's bigger, more expansive, and more encompassing than they had ever done before. Maybe that's what a mentor does. And so I started playing with that idea. Well, I've come to the conclusion, really, that my work, whether it's with leaders or artists or prophets or mystics, it's about mentoring the aspiring spirit, finding that spark and that germ of life in them that wants to grow and make a difference and connect with people and make something happen. So what is my work with leaders? It's working with people that are in a major transition in their lives. The way I put it for the elevator conversation in the business world is I help people make the move from management to leading. That's the short version. I'll give you the medium version. I won't give you the long version because that's a whole book, and that's what I like to do. I really like to write books. But so this is the medium version. And that is that they're in a point, they're at a stage in their lives when they've done the management job, they have the management job down, they're being looked to for that next step, and they're afraid of being in the position of faking it. They're afraid of being in the position of not knowing what it is that people expect of them or why it is that people respond to them at all. They're afraid. And so my job is to help them strip away, just lose all those things that keep you from yourself, that keep you from what it is that you want to accomplish. Come to be aware of what it is that you are offering. Step into your own self-trust. Announce your brand, what it is that you're offering your potential followers, and allow them to step into your arch. So that's what the work that I do is. And I've realized that what all this work centers around is that one idea that I call, or that we call, aspiration. And so that's really what I want to talk to you about tonight. I will also talk to you a little bit about leading, of course, because we're talking about the aspirations that some people have toward leading. And I want to tell you how this all came together to arrive at the point that we're at tonight. And that is that there were kind of three stages. Once this idea got going, there are kind of three stages of this work. First, I started just approaching it as another way to have a conversation and, you know, finding good questions to ask and, you know, good ways to generate conversation. But I really didn't have a sense of what this work could accomplish. So I started working at the Silicon Valley firm called Covad Communications. This is a telecommunications company. Over the course of 8 years of working there, I started to see what this work could do. I started to see that this work could really give people a new sense of themselves. This work could really give people a sense of how they could step out and create something larger and more encompassing. For some people, that actually meant leaving the company because they really wanted to go on to something, you know, they wanted to start something themselves. But for many, many people, that meant they found a way to dedicate themselves to the mission of the company, to let certain, you know, foibles and difficulties fall away so that they could step into something larger and more encompassing. Then, recently, the past few years, I've been working at Sandia National Laboratories. This is a place where, you know, at one time they made nuclear bombs. But now their mission has expanded into really considering global security in all its ramifications. And recently is the Japan disaster, and talking to one of the people that I work with that's literally in charge of Sandia's effort to do the calculations to determine the radiation risk throughout the area that affected by the Japanese plant. I started to realize that the shape of leading itself, the demands on leading itself, are changing drastically, you know, right before our eyes. And I'll want to talk to you about that in a moment. Now I'm in the process then of kind of going back, and I want to think about this mentoring process a little bit more. I've been invited to work with the American Mentoring Association and develop their best practices recommendations for certifying mentor programs throughout the country, and I'm looking forward to that. So mentoring, I've come to appreciate, is a really unique role. I think I won't go into all the ways that I think that it's undervalued and underappreciated and all the ways that I think that it is a necessary way for us to relate and develop our people in the future. But I can say this, you know, teaching is the great enterprise that expands our knowledge and expands our ability to engage in wider worlds. Coaching in the business world strengthens people's skills so that they can accomplish the specific tasks that are put before them at a very high level of excellence and competence. Then, of course, there's therapy that really helps people get healthy, so that they can get back into the fray and lead exciting and productive lives. But I really think it's only mentoring that treats people's aspirations. And by treats, I mean recognizes them, gives it voice, gives it a way for those aspirations to expand, take root, and then start affecting other people's lives. So right now, been at this for about 15 years. Right now, we have have a major group in Albuquerque doing our mentoring. We also have a major program in Boston. We have worked with clients from Intel, Covad Communications, and Boston Architecture College is using our program in their master's program. And, of course, we're doing extensive work with Sandia National Laboratories. We have community programs. What do we mean by community is we have volunteer mentors who work with people who come to us from the community, and we work with them one-on-one and provide a group context for their work. These are just people that come to us from the Albuquerque community, and now we have a program going on in Boston. So we have two of these programs going. We're now affiliated with the University of New Mexico's Mentoring Institute. I'd say we've mentored around 500 people during this time in various settings, and we have about 30 trained and certified mentors working in our program as well. It's a very, very bad business model that I don't recommend for anyone. It's very slow to get to explain to people what it is we're doing. It's very hard to find and train mentors, and the mentoring process takes a long time. But it's great work if you can get it. So now I want to talk to you a little bit about leadership. And I want to talk to you a little bit, let me start with talking to you how we look at leadership. You know, we're not looking at leaders from the standpoint of the organizations that they're in. Actually, even when we go into an organization, I make clear to our mentors, we don't know about the organization's politics. We don't know how the organization is structured. We don't even necessarily know what these people do. What we are there for is to understand where their aspirations are concerning leading. So the way we think about leading is very much oriented toward that particular exploration. So we talk about creative leaders, and by that we mean we don't think about leaders in terms of where they are in their hierarchy, what their specific job is, or what their specific role is. We're just looking at people that want to step into leading, that commit their lives to transforming more expansive and encompassing possibilities into realities. And leaders do this work by creating followers to serve in a collaborative effort, and then leaders guide the experience of all those involved as everyone strives toward that goal. Now, I want to emphasize, for the purposes of our talk tonight, I just want to emphasize the first point. And that is that we are talking about people making a commitment to shape and guide their lives in certain ways, in a certain way, that enables them to step into the life of leading. We're not interested in all the leadership skills that are all in all the handbooks that they might be involved in. We're interested in finding, where are you in your commitment? How deeply are you committed to this? Where does this commitment stand in relation to your family life, in relation to, you know, other parts of your life with your community? Where does this all fit? How does this fit? Our job is to understand the nature of their commitment and to encourage that commitment. And this is all very important when we get to thinking about the purpose of a liberal arts education. And it's all very important when we come to understand what it is that we mean by aspiration. Now, I need to talk to you for a moment about what it's like out there. In terms of leading, there's been a major phase shift in what I've seen in terms of being demanded of leaders, especially. It's been building up for the last 10 years, but in the last 5 years, it's just taken on a tremendous proportion. And in the last year, it's just hit me right between the eyes about what a different world in terms of leading we're in. The way we think about leading is in terms of hierarchy and defined organizations that have a set goal. We think about people sharing a common experience in terms of the culture of a company and that kind of thing. And then we think, of course, in terms of advancing up the hierarchy and getting paid more and having, more important positions in the company. And I just really want to say that model is just falling apart from every angle possible. On the small scale, you might say, smaller businesses come into existence and go out of existence. They start a project, they're a startup, they're getting things going. Either they run out of capital or they get bought out by another company. New management comes in and, all of a sudden, it's a new world in these companies. The competition in this world is really fierce. The good companies get bought out, their management changes. The average tenure of a CEO in the business community is 3.5 years. Hardly enough time to, learn the company. They accomplish something, and then it's time for them to move on, either by choice or the board asks them to do it. Then we start thinking of leading on the large scale. And of course, the disaster in Japan really brings it home. But think about the experiences that we've gone through in the past just a couple years. Katrina, the BP oil spill, the financial disasters. All of these things demand responses from leaders, but where's the organization? There's no organization. Where's the common culture? There's no common culture. You have all different people competing with different needs and different perspectives and different resource possibilities all over the place. You know, where is that common goal that we share? Well, you know, the financial community has one goal, and the business community on Main Street has another goal. Where's the common goal? How do you lead in that kind of a situation? Now, just on a day-to-day scale, in terms of some of the larger businesses out there, the speed and flow of information, whether it be through digital means or whether it be on Twitter or whatever, is just explosive in terms of the scale and the shape and the dynamics of that information. The capital and currency flows internationally in milliseconds. Engineers are hard at work developing programs that trade, that can trade faster and faster and faster. You wake up one morning thinking your stock is worth something and you have this much resources. You wake up and, you know, that's not the way it is anymore. You have the rise of new economies, major, powerful, dynamic economies that are just shaking up all of the world. You have tremendous competition for resources, whether it be for energy or natural resources or intellectual talent. So I'm saying what leading is up against, there are no boundaries now. The lid's off. So my point is, you know, how do you prepare for leading? And this is the message I would really like to say tonight and to convey to you tonight. And that is, you learn leading by deciding that you make a commitment to the life of leading. And that means that if you want to lead, then go out and find where you can lead and do that leading. Maybe it's in a community organization. You know, maybe it's on a spontaneous situation that arises where you feel you have something to offer and you can bring something to the table. We'll jump in. Learn the life of leading wherever that opportunity presents itself. And so then you will get to recognize when that opportunity for leading comes up wherever you are, whatever the circumstances are that you're in. So what you really need to do is think about if you have the aspiration to lead and whether you can commit to that aspiration. And what I really want to say to you tonight is whatever you do, keep that aspiration alive. So what do I mean by aspiration? Well, you know, I'm watching my grandson grow up, and as some of us know, that's a real thrill to see happen. So I see this young child, and he starts out his day. He starts out moment for moment, filled with wonder. He's putting this world together in spontaneous ways, in ways that are unexpected and just unimaginable, and really just, you know, a joy and a source of laughter. But then he really expects that something is going to happen from that. He really expects that out of this discovery, there's going to be another discovery. That out of this new wonder that he's happened on, there will be another wonder. So he goes about his life sensing, making his own sense of the world, discovering what the world is about, and then opening himself up to the fact that, wow, there's another moment of wonder around the corner. So he has an attitude of wonder. He anticipates that more wonder is there to be had. He wants to be accountable in that. He wants it to happen to him. And he wants to be seen and heard and know that he is in that moment of wonder. And he really accepts that this is the way it is. So I see the four aspects of aspiration being attitude, anticipation, accountability, and acceptance. And I'll be talking to you more about each of those in a moment. So, what do we mean by aspiration? We grown-ups, you know, we adults out here in the world. Well, regardless of how adult we are, by aspiration, we mean that we expect something to grow. We expect something to connect. We expect something to come together that makes a difference, that gives us a sense of wonder and excitement. Aspiration is that pulsing insistence that we bring into the world so that that wonder will happen. We have to be the source of that wonder. We have to be the source of that pulsing drive out into the world that's going to make something happen, that engenders those connections. So, you know, the point about being an adult as far as aspiration is concerned is not that we get jaded or cynical. When we've reached that point, or when you see others among you who have reached that point, they're gone. That aspiration is gone. For every little bit of cynicism and skepticism and reserve, there's a wound there somewhere. Somewhere other, that sense of wonder was blocked and hurt, and that person is afraid to go there again. No, the difference between an adult's aspiration and the child's aspiration is this, that the adult knows that aspiration has its work. There is the work of aspiration. So, that, to me, is the heart of the connection between what liberal arts is about and what the life of leading is about. Because, at least I can say from my own experience, what I learned at Dickinson was the life of aspiration and the work of aspiration. I learned that there were people out there who had done the work, who had hoped for something, who had dreamed for something, and they did the work to put it down, to put it in writing, to put it in works of art so that others could relate to that experience. And I learned that it's very hard work to understand and to get a hold of what these people were trying to say. In the case of one of the people that I studied, it's taken 40 years. And I have to say, I started out with just the B in Hegel. And I spent the next 40 years trying to get to an A. But that's hard. It was hard work. And aspiration is that hard work. So what is the work of aspiration? It's learning that ideas come from somewhere, that they have a source, that they sprung up in certain circumstances because people had certain kinds of problems and issues that they felt a driving need to address and have people engage. So all different kinds of sciences arose, and literature arose, and poetry arose, and philosophy and theology arose. All these different discourses and languages and ways of looking at the world. So that we could engage, we humans can engage this world in some kind of a way that carries our aspiration forward. That's what you learn here. And what is so thrilling about a liberal arts education is you learn all these different languages. You learn the language of literature and philosophy, and you learn this language of physics and biology. You learn the language of organizational development and organizational work. You learn how it is that the work of aspiration is what keeps aspiration alive. My role as the mentor actually is to restore to people the ability to step into that work and to step into that learning once again. And to once again step into that role where they are learning how to nurture and develop their aspiring spirit. And so, my friends, my message tonight is keep those aspirations alive. Your liberal arts education is a great gift. And you've learned to envision other worlds in many different languages and logics. You've learned the different ways that whole worlds come to be and pass away. Don't leave that work behind. I did leave that work behind once. I made a decision, you know, after graduate school that I was going to leave all this. I was done with Hegel and I was done all this stuff. I was going to go out and I was going to be a businessman. I was going to, you know, make my mark out there, make a lot of money. I was gonna be the, you know, the shining light of business success. And it just about killed me. And really, one of the great moments of kind of my recovery from that self-inflicted wound of abandoning my aspirations came when one day, for some reason, I wandered up to the attic. And there I saw on the floor all my books from Dickinson, my books from my religious courses, my philosophy courses, Paul Tillich, the Courage to Be, works on, you know, Husserl's phenomenology, and of course, you know, these Hegel's philosophy of history, and all these wonderful books. And I started thumbing through them again. I started looking at them again. I started reading these words again. And I realized, holy cow, I was living in the midst of the greatest thinking and the greatest spirit that this human endeavor had to offer. And I decided that moment, I brought those books down and I started reading again. And that's what got me on my course so that I'm here to speak to you today. So the questions of aspiration are, you know, what are the great and new worlds that you envision? How do you envision more expansive and more encompassing possibilities for the human endeavor? Who are the predecessors and the forebears of the traditions and the science and the logic and the discourse that you are declaring as your major or that you are saying is your interest? How do you bring others into those? What do you do to make that world appealing and interesting and effective and powerful for others? And what I would say, don't despair at the immensity of the task. Organize, create followers, bring them in. But whatever you do, keep your aspirations alive. So let's go back to those four A's. What do you anticipate? Know that the world that you're going to is fast-moving, complex, and accelerating. At Dickinson, you've learned to learn. And so you can always expand your sense of anticipation if you keep learning. Learn how systems organize and become more complex. As my yoga instructor says, there's no such thing as a perfect pose. If the universe had a goal, we would have reached it by now. Learning is how we stay alive in this universe. Keep your learning alive. Accountability, what do we mean by that? For the grown-up aspirant, it means do the work. Do the work. Do the work that leaders do. Hone your vision. Learn your predecessors and the people that have gone before you. Learn to express what it is that you want to put into the world with power, with precision, with clarity. That's why you write all these papers. That's why you're doing this work, so that you are honing those skills of communication so that you too can be powerful and open up worlds of expression to others. What about acceptance? One of the things that I found is there comes a time in the life of my mentees when the world can't give them what they need. They can't be promoted into another position. They literally have to go, if they are going to act on their aspirations, they have to go out and make something else happen. They have to put something of their own and something new into the world. And if you're lucky and brave and you're true to your aspirations, you'll accept that realization and you'll make that step. But the first thing is you have to be committed to that aspiration. You have to be committed to keeping that aspiration alive. So finally, we get to the attitude. And of course, you know, one of the titles of my books don't include the word success in them. Instead, I use the word lead greatly, or finding great leaders. The title of this talk is Lead Greatly. I don't use the word success. I think success in the relation of leading is a fiction, and I think it's a dangerous fallacy. But one of the conversations that we had in one of the classes actually was, I was asked in an interview today about what about failure, and I would say that, you know, any leader worth his salt is putting something of aspiration that's aspirational out there in the world knows failure intimately. Gandhi really felt that at most he was marginally effective. He failed in terms of stopping the untouchable caste. He failed in terms of the failure to have the Muslims and the Hindus form a unified country. He felt that he had failed. So success is not a word that fits in the lexicon of leading, but greatly does. And I'd like you to keep this idea of what we mean by great in mind. I have two senses of what we mean by great. When I ask my mentees, name someone that's great in your life, they're likely to name their grandfather, or maybe their father, or maybe their brother, someone that had an effect on their lives, someone that really touched them and moved them and enabled them to step out in their own lives in a different way. So the first thing about great is that you affect people's lives. Be willing to do that. Then the second thing about great, especially as far as leading is concerned, is that you're willing to step into a situation knowing full well that you will never emerge from this, you will emerge from this step one way or another, a changed and transformed person. You will not be the same person you were when you are in the midst of and when this situation is done. And I think about the likes of leaders of the likes of Lincoln, for instance, who knew stepping into this moment that he would never emerge out of this the same as he went in. When he gave his farewell address at Springfield, I think he might have even had a sense that he would never return to that place either. I think of just so many great leaders who have taken on challenges and it's worn them down, it's made them tired, but it never made them cynical. And so, yes, they emerged differently than when they came in, and maybe they emerged greater. So, from the wonderful people you have here around you, your faculty and your fellow students, the people that are putting these great institutes and programs together for you, I think you have a sense of what great means. From the studies that you've done of the great figures that were pioneers in your field, think of the Curies and what they went through to establish their field and the sacrifice they made to others in all other fields, great historical figures that never made it out of the battles that they stepped into. I think you have a sense of what you know what great means. So the question is, you know, what do you want to do? What are you committed to? And what I would say to you is don't be daunted. Summon your commitment, stir your aspirations, buckle down and do the work. So in my mentoring and conclusion, I just want you to know I have just one message that I would like you to consider. I would like you to think about you becoming awake to the living that you are. become awake and alert and alive to that sense of spirit and aspiration that you have burning inside of you. Keep those pulsing intentions alive. Feed them, nurture them, do the work. But whatever you do, keep your aspirations alive. Thank you.
It's certainly inspiring to hear how well graduates of this school can do, especially for philosophy majors, I think. On a personal note, it's been absolutely enriching having met you, having talked to you in classes around campus, and now this wonderful lecture. So on behalf of the Clark Forum and Dickinson College, if I could just give you this token of our appreciation as a thank you for all your work.
We are now going to begin a short question and answer session. So if you have a question, please raise your hand and I'll wait for the microphone to reach you.
Should I go back up?
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about a leader that reflects your notion of aspirational leadership in a historical sense?
Well, I think we ought to look at Barack Obama. I think that this is a person that what can I say? He could have gone in many different ways. I think about the way he moved through his life. He could have graduating from Harvard Law School and that kind of thing. He could have gone to Harvard Law Review. He could have gone to any big law firm, made any kind of money that he wanted, and that kind of thing. But instead, he had a different kind of aspiration, so what did he do? He became a community worker. And then I think his aspiration even, I just remember this so poignantly, he was interviewed by Steve Croft on 60 Minutes, and he was saying, here you are, a young man, and you're stepping into a situation with a financial crisis, two wars, budget problems, ballooning, a divided, political situation. How do you feel about that? And he just very calmly and resolutely, and I think with just great power, said, I think I'm in the right place. And I think that's how the aspiring leader feels when he's stepping into that situation in which he may or may not become great. Yes, Dan.
You have a grandson. What kinds of things would you do with a grandson as he grows for him to get some notion of what he aspires to do and be prepared to do it?
Well, I'm a grandparent, so I'm not doing the hard lifting. But his parents are just exquisite in that regard. I mean, they have a full sense of the aspiring life all around them. And he doesn't watch TV. He doesn't eat sugar. He at 5 years old, he's learning to play the piano. When he was 3 years old, he was out hitting tennis balls. He had a sense that, he could step out into life and make things happen around him. He was read to literally before he was born, and all throughout his life, he was read to constantly. He could literally, he'd pick out a book, and he'd open it up, and he would, before he could read, he could tell you what was on the page. He could tell you the words that were on the page. He's learning to do the work. And he's learning that, what he can put out there can make a difference and that he can have an effect on what's happening in his life. Yes.
Thanks for coming. you mentioned that how, useful and how valuable liberal arts education is, but actually in the real business world, a lot of times you're going to compete with young students or graduates who are really already learned the skills they need, you know, in the finance or in marketing. They seem to know already a lot about the hands-on skills. And us from Dickinson, even though we have a great education background, but we lack the real-world skills. So maybe in the first couple of years, you might experience the, you know, like the problem and feel like you're falling behind in a competition. So how would you deal with that situation, and what kind of advice would you give to young graduates from Dickinson?
Two things. You know, I really believe that with the education you have here, you can learn any of that stuff, you know, whenever you need to, at whatever pace you need to, without a hitch. If you want to take a course, take a course, but after what your experience here, you can learn it yourself. So, you know, just do the work. And then the second thing, the most important thing, is keep your aspirations alive. Don't fall for it. Do the work that you have to do. Learn the skills that you need to learn. Absolutely. But don't lose your aspirations. Don't give that up. So those are the two things. And I think your observation about, you know, yeah, maybe you'll be a little, it might seem that you're a little bit behind, you know, to start with. You know, I think that's a very, very, you know, worthy observation. You know, don't worry. Don't worry. You know, do the work. You'll be there, and, you know, you'll do just fine. Yes.
Hi.
Hello.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Obviously, I think political leadership is pretty important. I'm in Professor Rudalevich's political leadership class. But I was wondering if you could speak a little bit about any leaders you see outside of politics that embody your concept of a good leader, whether in business or in something else altogether, and why.
Well, I'll start with, I guess, there are many leaders that I've encountered, especially people at Sandia, for instance, and at COVAD, too, that just moved me beyond, I mean, just taught me everything that's worthwhile knowing about, you know, my professional work. So any of those people I could talk about. But let's talk about someone we all know who is a fascinating figure, and that's Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs started out with a great idea, and then he went and he pushed this idea, and, you know, he made it into something. And Steve Jobs had a very, very clear idea that the computer would be a bicycle for the mind. That was his idea. And boy, has he ever put that into effect. Well, but you know, he didn't learn how to create followers. He knew how to do stuff. You know, he knew he was really bright, but he didn't know how to create followers. In Silicon Valley, when I was working there, I worked with many Apple veterans. And when I mentioned the name Steve Jobs there, you know, they just go ballistic at what an asshole, excuse the expression, but that's their word, he is. Well, you know, then Steve Jobs, life hit Steve Jobs. He was forced out of Apple by the person that he picked, by the way, to, you know, John Sculley, to be president of Apple. And then he went to Next Computer, where he met people that were just as smart, just as bright, just as capable, just as imaginative as he was. And they failed. They failed at getting that computer out there. Well, then, by the way, that kind of group morphed. They kind of took their technology into the entertainment industry, and that kind of morphed into Pixar and the ability to create these animated things. And, of course, we all know that, you know, Pixar is now the new Shakespearean acting company of our culture. You know, everything they do is brings tears to your eyes and, you know, makes you feel like, you know, gee, I have some balloons. Maybe I could try that. You know. So then Steve Jobs comes back to Apple, and he builds a team around him. He puts people around him that he respects, and he shows them respect. He sets this thing loose, and what does he do? He puts things out there into the world that we've never even imagined, you know, we could ever need. I'm talking to you from an iPad, and I assure you, I promise you, a year ago that idea never occurred to me, and I certainly never thought I'd ever want it. So he started to learn. Now, do I think Steve Jobs, what I call an Arch 3 leader, and the arch and the path, there are three arches where, you know, that Arch 3 leader is wherever you go, leading happens. You don't even need an organization around you. Just, you know, leading happens because, you know, you've stepped onto the scene. No, I don't think he is. He's an Arch 2 leader who had a vision, who built an organization around him, and, you know, that's become his life, and that's where he'll be. Maybe he'll be an Arch 3 leader, maybe when he comes through this illness, and I certainly hope he does. You know, he will, maybe he'll be ready to step into that next phase. But that's an example.
You commented about how the developments that were going on in the economy, in the sense that there was more, what would you call, it's more fluid, there's more globalization, there's more, if you will, instability, you might say. Does that make your model of leadership more difficult or more appropriate?
More appropriate. You know, everything we talk about, again, what we're talking about is you developing, stepping into the life of leading, because you commit to doing the work that your aspiration to be a leader entails. So where you're on a path so that wherever you go, leading happens. And that's what we need. In the Japan situation, you step into the situation, and you need to lead where you are. And that leading needs to happen. You know, there has to be some leader that's taking these incredible people into the heart of this reactor, into the heart of this nuclear radioactive maelstrom, and enabling some kind of a process to happen.
We have time for one more question.
Jim?
A leader mentoring program at an institution of higher learning, could you describe what that might look like?
It would be, I guess, in my vision. Thank you, Jim, for that leading question. You know, in my version, it would be that not only is there the profession of teaching that's offered, but there is also the opportunity of mentoring. So professors would also be mentors. They would also be involved in the way the students live and involved in making the intellectual enterprise come alive. And I want to say, by the way, that's exactly the experience that I had here with George and Dan. We were all involved in this enterprise together. We shared the sense of this intellectual life was alive and was a part of what we were doing. And anything that we can do, so a mentoring program would be fostering that attitude. And then it would be students also, maybe seniors, mentoring other students so that they would be entered and ushered into the life of intellectual pursuit and intellectual discussion and working on their aspirations with a sense that there were others around them so that it would all matter. Everyone would matter to each other, all gathered around this enterprise of making their aspirations come alive. So the mentors would be trained. People would be trained in mentoring. You know, I'm on a best practices committee. There's a methodology of mentoring. There are certain things that need to happen in mentoring. With training, we can make sure that those things happen. And that can happen both for students that become mentors as well as faculty. And we can use this, as we do in businesses, to build a sense of community, not just the business, not just getting things done, but a sense that we all have a sense of shared responsibility and a sense of shared joy at what it is we can all bring to each other. So Thank you for that question.
On behalf of Dickinson College and the Clark Forum, please join me in thanking Dr. Michael Shankman.